Marketplace is produced in association with the University of Southern California.
Coming up today on the broadcast, the political upside of shutting things down. Measuring an economy when the measurers aren't working. And Malcolm Gladwell on how underdogs sometimes aren't. From American Public Media, this is Marketplace.
Wake up to the day's top business headlines. Subscribe to the Marketplace Morning Report podcast. It's on iTunes and marketplace.org/podcasts.
From the Frank Stanton Studios in Los Angeles, I'm Kai Rizdahl. This is the Marketplace Podcast for Wednesday, the 2nd of October. Great, as always, to have you with us. And we are going on 48 hours now of government interrupt us. The president is sitting down this afternoon with congressional leaders, but nobody has indicated there's going to be any actual negotiating going on. Positions are still firm. Differences between the two sides are being made ever more clear. And you know what that is, right? That's what you call a business opportunity, ladies and gentlemen. And the business end of politics is raising money. Marketplace's Chrissy Clark gets us going.
The Democratic National Committee says it's raised nearly $2 million online since the weekend. DNC spokesman Mo Alathy says Monday alone was record-breaking. 30,000 individual donors, many of them first time.
Our biggest fundraising day since before the 2012 election. I think it was a combination of a lot of excitement about Obamacare about to go live, as well as a lot of frustration with the dysfunction in Congress and the Republican shutdown.
Over at the Republican National Committee, Press Secretary Kirsten Kukowski sees the Democrats' fundraising windfall differently. Surprise, surprise.
We're kind of wondering if the reason that they have refused to come to the table over the last couple of days is because they feel like they're getting something out of it monetarily.
But Republicans are getting something out of it, too.
We've raised over $1 million in the last 48 hours. So we've seen a great response, a lot of feedback on government shutdown, on Obamacare.
They've been strategizing about this for months.
Stephen Smith is a political scientist at Washington University, and when he says they've been strategizing, he means both parties. Capitalizing on a moment like this isn't something these guys just thought of this week.
You know, they prepared mailings, they prepared emails, they've got fancy websites.
It's easy to get cynical about all the donations that are flooding into both parties right now. But Sheila Krumholtz with the Center for Responsive Politics says at least it's a sign that people are finally engaged.
If we had millions of individuals giving small donations, we'd likely have a much healthier political system.
Of course, we don't know exactly who's giving the donations right now, big donors or small ones, because the Federal Elections Commission that monitors that stuff is shut down. I'm Chrissy Clark for Marketplace.
Well, along those lines, here is a not entirely rhetorical question. If an economy grows or adds jobs, or if consumer spending rises or falls, and there's nobody there working in the office that measures it, did it happen? The government gathers and analyzes and publishes economic information all the time. Jobs, inflation, you know the drill. But what happens when the data isn't available? Marketplace's Abri Benishore has that story.
Here's a list of data that either won't get released or won't get collected while the government is shut down.
The retail sales report.
Factory orders report.
Inflation.
International trade.
The September employment report. The big daddy of all the economic indicators.
That's Chris Lowe with FDN Financial. And that big daddy indicator is supposed to come out this Friday. All this data is important for investors. Keith Davis is with Farr Miller in Washington.
It stretches on 2 or 3 weeks. Investment advisors like ourselves are kind of going to be running blind. We're going to have to make investment decisions without knowing how fast the recovery is going and whether it's accelerating or decelerating.
That's likely to make markets volatile. And the data that's not getting collected right now, like inflation or jobs for October, may never get collected. There is non-government data out there, but in the past few months, it's painted a misleadingly strong impression of the economy, says Chris Lowe.
If we were forced to rely on the private sector data we get, interest rates would probably be quite a bit higher right now.
But because government figures have shown the economy is weaker, the Fed has kept interest rates low. Now, look, a few missed data releases in normal times isn't the end of the world. Justin Wolfers is at the Brookings Institution.
The problem is, if we're about to face abnormal times, and Congress appears to be trying to make times abnormal, we won't be able to see it immediately or obviously in the data.
So basically, we can't tell how bad the government shutdown is for the economy because of the government shutdown. In New York, I'm Sabri Benishore for Marketplace.
And again, along those lines, was it the shutdown, the looming debt limit fight, just a lousy day at the corner of Wall Street and Broad? I have no idea, but we'll have the details when we do the numbers. Nearly 5 million people visited healthcare.gov yesterday, the main website for the new insurance exchanges. Another 5 million or so were expected today. Whether they'll have better luck is anybody's guess. But technical hiccups or not, buying health insurance online is the future. Convenient for customers, yes. Not such great news, though, for the umpteen thousand insurance agents and brokers who depend on commissions to make their living. From the help desk at WHYY, Marketplace's Dan Gorenstein reports.
Business has been hopping this week for Virginia-based insurance broker Jonathan Katz.
In the last 2 days, I've received over 40 calls and 50 emails a day just about current clients asking, what are we going to do with my current plan? What's my situation?
Katz knows that questions and sales aren't the same thing. And with millions of new customers shopping for insurance under Obamacare, a lot of future sales are going to happen online without a broker. Still, Katz thinks he's got an edge.
Have you tried to get on healthcare.gov?
Yep.
Have you been successful?
Nope.
Well, you know, there you go.
Brokers are hoping the technical glitches, along with the complicated nature of health insurance, premiums, deductibles, government subsidies, and all the rest, will drive consumers straight to that quaint office in the neighborhood. That's a nice fantasy, says University of Pennsylvania's Tom Baker.
If insurance companies can get enough business through exchanges where they aren't going to have to pay brokerage fees, then they're going to prefer to go through the insurance exchanges.
Fierce price competition on the exchanges could also eat away at brokers' commissions, but Baker thinks some insurance agents will adapt and survive.
Expedia is an example of a travel agent that reinvented itself for the internet, and that a broker could be similar.
Baker says the Jonathan Katzes of the world could develop sophisticated websites that allow consumers to shop just like the exchanges do. But with more than 100,000 brokers in the mix, lots of them are going to be looking for new jobs. I'm Dan Gorenstein for Marketplace.
Tom Clancy, master of the political military thriller, has died. He was 66 years old. Many of Clancy's best-selling novels became box office gold. His name was on video games and board games. Not bad for a guy who started out professionally as an insurance agent. If you really think about it, Tom Clancy was a brand, just like any other big-name asset. Marketplace's Adrienne Hill looks at what happens to that brand now.
Tom Clancy's best-known character is analyst-turned-reluctant-hero-turned-president Jack Ryan, a character around long enough that he's been played by Alec Baldwin.
I am not field personnel. I am only an analyst.
You're perfect. I'm expendable.
Harrison Ford.
Why was I left out of it?
You see everything in black and white.
Not black and white. Right and wrong.
Ben Affleck.
It's Ryan! The bomb is in play!
And later this year by Chris Pine. No tape of that one yet. Jim Milliot is with Publishers Weekly. He says Tom Clancy was one of the first authors as brands. People wanted what Clancy had.
They want to go to the movies to see a Clancy movie. They want to play a video game because it's a Clancy video game.
And the Clancy name is going strong. A new Clancy video game is coming out next year. In December, there'll be a new Jack Ryan novel, the Jack Ryan movie I mentioned. Jack Ryan may just be the next James Bond.
He cares about his responsibility. He functions on a global level.
Jason E. Squire teaches the movie business at USC.
It's really, you know, global political thriller is the category that we're probably talking about. And what could be better in this age of global blockbuster movies?
Squire thinks it's up to the estate and the studio to stay true to the character that Tom Clancy created. I'm Adrienne Hill for Marketplace.
This is, if you'd somehow missed it, National Cybersecurity Awareness Month. The Department of Homeland Security says so. The government and the high-tech industry are trying to spread the word about keeping your data and your privacy protected online because the bad guys are everywhere. You know, But the once dark art of computer hacking has become, in some cases, a regular 9-to-5 day job. There's a public sector and a private sector, even corporate recruiters and HR people as well. Arthi Shahani reports.
Vincent Liu is, at age 31, one of America's best hackers. As a kid, he hacked into video games, and in his 20s, he worked for the NSA. But these days, instead of hunched over a keyboard breaking into systems, Liu spends most of his time on the road and in conference rooms. He runs a firm of hackers for hire. And when I met him, he was at Caesars Palace Las Vegas, headhunting top-notch hackers at a conference.
You're not going to put a resume on Monster and find that person. It's just not going to happen. You know, those people are in extremely high demand. They kind of command salaries that are well, you know, into the six figures.
Liu's website does not list the companies who hire him. He handles such sensitive business, when he's in conference rooms showing off to his own clients, they get spooked by the work product.
People have gotten up, stopped the meeting, and said, quote, you've gone too far, you know. We've stolen plans for military equipment.
Liu pulls out his own laptop and shows me a movie of his team hacking into a Fortune 100 manufacturing conglomerate. They download employee names and license plate numbers, create ID cards to swipe themselves into data centers.
We were just showing off. It's what we get paid to do. We really want to drive home the point.
And how much do you get paid for something like this?
Anywhere from $50,000 to $200,000.
Liu isn't the only one capitalizing on the demand for cybersecurity. Search the term hacker for hire on Google, and you get 1-800 numbers like...
Thank you for calling Neighborhood Hacker, professional hackers for hire. If you know your party's extension, you may dial it at any time.
The unemployment rate for cyber professionals is zero.
Richard Schaefer is retired from the NSA. He says back in the day, hacking was such a specialized field, they only employed the very best.
I was there 35 years, and 1975, I was one of 150 people hired. They hire 1,000 people a year now.
That number doesn't even count the consultants like Edward Snowden. One industry report says there are already 340,000 jobs in cybersecurity. Schaefer says while the Pentagon has strict quality controls, the private sector, like a 1-800 number to hire a hacker, does not.
That means that we have practitioners out there being paid more, given more responsibility than their skill level deserves, and so mistakes are being made.
Before hacking ever became a job description, there was another conference for the underground. It's called DEF CON. DEF CON started in the 1990s as anti-establishment. Today, some say it's just another job fair. CJ, who wouldn't give his last name, is an elder here, and he says it's not the same.
It's become almost a professional culture now. Less of the guys on skateboards and more of the guys in suits walking around. It's kind of bad because I think money doesn't come for everything, you know?
Vinny Liu agrees that the money has changed things. It's made hacking a business, which to him it should be.
Some of us have mortgages and families and kids, and that's the lifestyle that some of us want to lead.
More money and higher pay values the people, like him, who are good at this. In Las Vegas, I'm Arthi Shahani for Marketplace.
Coming up, you wake up, you run out for scones. One for you, one for Fido.
There's around like 60 different treats for dogs. They all made on location by our pastry chef.
You ain't heard nothing yet, people. But first, let's do the numbers. All right, you take one disappointing private sector jobs report, you throw in the aforementioned government shutdown, and you've got a recipe for a meh kind of day on Wall Street. The Dow Industrials dropped 58 points, 0.4%, closed at 15,133. It wasn't supposed to sound like that meh. The NASDAQ subtracted 2 points, not quite a 0.1%, ended at 3815. The S&P 500 down 1 point, also about a 0.1%, closed at 1693. Monsanto, the world's biggest seed company, sold fewer seeds last quarter and posted a loss. Its stock fell 1%. Struggling smartphone maker BlackBerry ticked up 1% on word that it may get a second buyout offer from Cerberus. Bond prices rose. The yield on the 10-year T-note fell to 2.62%. And you're listening to Marketplace.
Show Marketplace how much you like us. Stay connected to our hosts, reporters, and top stories on Facebook. Find us at facebook.com/APM Marketplace.
From the Marketplace Datebook, here's a glance at what's coming up Thursday. In Washington, the Commerce Department was scheduled to release its monthly report on factory orders, but the website is shut down. The National Chicken Council convenes its annual conference in the nation's capital. And let's talk about the weather and the oceans. The National Oceanic and Atmospheric Administration was established on October 3, 1970. I'm Michelle Phillippe.
This is Marketplace from APM. I'm Kai Rizdahl. Shutdown aside, there were still plenty of people in Washington today who did go to work, not because they're essential government employees, but because they don't work for the government at all. So we talked to a couple of local businesses there to see how business is during a shutdown.
We depend a lot on local employees. I can definitely see a slowdown even today.
I generally think we'll be okay.
I might have to cut back on staff. Hopefully I won't have to because a majority of my people have been with me for anywhere from 10 to 31 years. I really hate to do that. More tomorrow.
That was Dave Compton at Hello Cupcake, Anya Agu at One District Taco, and Jody Taylor at the Black Rooster Pub, all of them in Washington, D.C., the nation's capital. Author and New Yorker magazine staff writer Malcolm Gladwell has this thing he does with his books. He takes ideas, or sometimes what's considered conventional wisdom, and he turns it inside out, rolls it around, and finds a twist or an angle that makes you think about things differently. The Tipping Point, Outliers, and his latest, David and Goliath. It's about why underdogs can win if they realize they're not really underdogs. Malcolm, welcome to the program.
Glad to be here.
Why did you want to write about underdogs?
Because we're obsessed with them, first of all. Why do we return again and again to the subject of seemingly lopsided conflicts? So one, I wanted to sort of explain that obsession. And two, I thought that the ways in which we misread these conflicts are symptomatic of something deeper, which is I don't think that we have a good sense of what an advantage really is or a disadvantage. We have those categories mixed up, and I wanted to kind of sort through them and say, you know, things that we thought were real advantages actually aren't, and things that we think of as overwhelming obstacles actually are incredibly useful.
Pick up on that for a second, and I want you to do it with the story of David Boies. For those who don't know, he's one of the top trial lawyers in this country. He was involved in the gay marriage decision and Microsoft. I mean, he is a lawyer's lawyer. And,
yes.
And yet you found and write about this obstacle that he has.
So here we have one of the greatest lawyers in the country, and he is profoundly dyslexic. He reads basically one book a year. He finds reading difficult and painful. Now, think about that for a moment. He's a lawyer. Yeah. He's in a profession that has reading at its absolute core, right? And so when I talked to him, I said, well, how did you become such a successful lawyer in spite of this disability? And he said, not in spite. I became a successful lawyer because of this so-called disability. And he explained to me how he spent his life compensating for this. He learned how to listen, and he also developed an extraordinary memory. So he would sit in school, later in law school, but he would sit in school and he didn't take notes because it was pointless. What he did is he sat and listened to the teacher and remembered everything that was said. Those two skills turned out to be far more useful than you'd think in getting through school. But more importantly, when he becomes a trial lawyer, what's being a great trial lawyer all about? Well, in part, it's about listening very, very closely to what the person you're cross-examining or whatever you're doing with is saying, and then being able to summon that in the moment. So he's famous for confronting the witness and saying, well, 3 days ago in cross-examination, you said the following thing, right? He'd been working on those skills his entire life.
And yet David Boies, you in the last part of the chapter about him, he has two children who are who are dyslexic. And he talks about the emotion of watching them struggle. And that to me is the thing that's different about this book than other Gladwellian books, is that there's an emotional part of this, you know, the disadvantage and the obstacles, you know?
Yeah, this every other successful dyslexic I talked to said that even though they consider their own success a function of their dyslexia, would never wish that disability on any of their own children. And that's a big theme of my book, that we owe so much to what people learn in overcoming adversity, and yet that does not mean we should romanticize adversity at all.
There is, and you'll, I apologize for using this phrase, there is a tipping point when an underdog becomes the favorite, becomes the Goliath. You know, when Microsoft started, it was this little two-man shop in, where was it, Albuquerque, hustling for contracts. And now look at it. Where's that balance, and how do you figure it out, and how crucial is that?
Oh, it's such a great question. One, by the way, which I don't really get into in this book.
Right, which is why I'm asking you about it.
Yeah, and I should, you know, either I should or I should do a sequel. Because it's a great question. I talk about these categories as if they're static, and they're not. Microsoft is a great example. Was a classic underdog. You know, did all kinds of, was nimble, fast-moving, audacious, all the things that underdogs are. They are not anymore. They are now a massive Goliath, encumbered by all of the weaknesses of giants, right? Slow-moving, lumbering, lacking imagination. It's very difficult for individuals or institutions who were once David to understand that they are no longer Davids. In the present world, where adapting to new changes in technologies quickly and effectively is so important, what's wrong with being smaller? Isn't that an advantage?
The most recent book by Malcolm Gladwell is called David and Goliath. Malcolm, thanks very much for your time.
Thank you so much, Guy.
If you know Malcolm Gladwell at all, you know the original interview went way longer than that. We've got the whole thing online, marketplace.org. The American Pet Products Association tells us that last year, Americans spent 53.33 billion simoleons on, for, and because of our pets. The wealthier the city, the more we spend. You go to Yelp and you search for dog-related businesses in San Francisco, you get more than 650 hits. There aren't good hard numbers for how big the dog economy is, but what we do know is that investors are starting to take note. Casey Miner of KALW has the story.
Let's say you wanted to take your dog out on Union Street in San Francisco's Marina District. So first, you pick Fluffy up where you left her that morning.
The Moulin Pooch Doggy Daycare. Grooming is our most popular demand.
Moulin Pooch is a dog boutique and villa. Fancy. It would be nice to stick around for yappy hour, but there are plenty of other places to find treats.
This is Limercel Dog Bakery. It's a full-scale bakery for dogs. There's around like 60 different treats for dogs. They're all made on location by our pastry chef.
Oh, and actually, I forgot to mention this. It's Fluffy's special day.
Of course, birthday cakes come in like 4 different sizes, 2 different flavors.
This is just one street. One tiny slice of the dog services the Bay Area has to offer. There's a dogumentary photographer and an animal communicator. There are dog Reiki practitioners and dog massage therapists. And this being San Francisco, there are, of course, entrepreneurs.
So we have Bailey, we have snacks. Let's see, who else is in there? Holly.
Just a few years ago, Anna Gill was a corporate attorney, and she needed somewhere to bring her basset hound, Truman, while she was at work. She saw an opportunity, and in 2009, she opened Dogpile Dogs Daycare. Now, she watches between 80 and 100 dogs a day.
I retired from the practice of law from Genentech to open this place, and my life savings essentially is into this place. So I'm very grateful and thankful that it has worked out.
Gil doesn't advertise, but she's attracted so much business that for a while she had to stop accepting new dogs, just to keep the numbers manageable. And she's earned enough money to start expanding.
We're about to open up the south end there and create a little senior oasis for some of the older dogs. It'll be really nice. They'll have a nice sun deck for them to lay out on, gentle sloping steps where they're going to be wide and they can sleep on them.
The boom in dog services has also caught the attention of tech startups. Rover and Dog Vacay, based in Seattle and LA, are Airbnbs for your dog. Swifto, based in New York City, calls itself the Uber of dog walking. And then there's San Francisco-based Whistle. Ben Jacobs is the company's CEO.
So this is my dog. This is Duke. First thing you see is his total minutes of activity.
Whistle is a dog activity tracker, a little device you can attach to your dog's collar that records how much she's moving around each day, and an app that monitors health trends over time.
The number one concern for any owner is their animal's wellness and their happiness. You know, it's phrased in terms of the dog's not only health, but also emotion.
And our emotions influence how we use our wallets. Whistle launched this month with around 20 employees and $6 million in startup capital. In San Francisco, I'm Casey Miner for Marketplace.
Marketplace is produced in association with the University of Southern California's Annenberg School for Communication and Journalism.
This final note on the way out, cribbed from NetNet. That's the blog that our friend John Carney runs over at CNBC. John blogged today about a new dress code at Barclays, Super Casual Friday, it's called. Jeans, fine. T-shirts, fine. Even sneakers in an investment bank, also fine. Not fine at all, though, with some of the old timers. Quote, "I didn't become an investment banker to dress like a perpetual teenager," said a veteran of Lehman Brothers. "It's ridiculous. Please make them stop. It's like working at a startup, but without the IPO," said another. Or, you know, public radio, said me. All right, we're done. That is Marketplace from APM. Carlos Asensio, Ravi Carman, Chris Clark, Stephen Colon, Bill Lanch, Jeff Peters, Charlton Thorpe, Brendan Willard, and Randy Wine engineered the broadcast for us. I'm Kai Rizdahl. We'll see you tomorrow, everybody. And this is APM.
All over the country,
we need to improve reading in Wisconsin.
Schools are changing the way they teach reading.
I'm calling for a renewed focus on literacy.
We have gotten this wrong in New York and all across the nation.
And it's happening because of a podcast.
I think your podcast has changed my life.
And I'm going to share this podcast with everyone I meet.
Sold a Story investigates how teaching kids to read went wrong. New episodes of Sold a Story are available now.